The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So, I'd love to begin with something cheery, but we're talking about the Holocaust. The Holocaust really defies descriptions for its horror, not just the death toll, more than 11 million murdered through overwork, starvation, and disease in ghettos and concentration camps, or simply exterminated, gassed, or shot. It was the targeting of what was called an unfit in the population, not just for an attack, but systematic murder over the course of years. Using factory methods and modern technology, including people may know a primitive computer system, the IBM punch card system, to keep track of prisoners, which of course was provided by the American corporation. The Holocaust would have been inconceivable without modern industrial capitalism. In the midst of progress, it was the height of barbarism, unprecedented in human history. The Holocaust was also the culmination of a particularly vile capitalist ideology, fascism, which showed, I think, for all succeeding generations, the danger of fascist ideas and movements. The rise of fascism and the triumph of Hitler was certainly a historic defeat for the left and the working class. The left parties, the communists and the social democrats, were actually much larger than the Nazi party when you combined them. But actually, the concentration camps, the ghettos, and the extermination camps were not, as it's often described, the final defeat and the end of the road. Resistance continued, not just in rare isolated cases, but throughout the Nazi machinery of death. Nearly every concentration camp, every ghetto, had organized resistance. In addition, many partisan and resistance forces throughout Europe were comprised of Jews or had Jewish leadership and actively tried to stop the massacre of Jews and other Nazis, and others that the Nazis deemed undesirable. The resistance is incredibly broad, and I'm not going to get to talk about all of it, or even what deserves to be talked about in this talk. I'm going to concentrate on really the most desperate situation, but also the situation that required self-organization by the victims of the Holocaust. That is, what was going on in the concentration camps and the ghettos. And I'm going to talk about how this resistance operated and give some examples, which can illustrate what was going on. So people may know Hitler came to power in January 1933. The next month there was a fire in the Reichstag, their parliament building, which was blamed on the communists. In March they constructed the first concentration camp to hold political prisoners and others. The concentration camp was Dachau, run by the dreaded SS, a special Nazi paramilitary unit. Dachau would be the first of many. At first, these concentration camps held political prisoners, communists and others, but also convicts, or people who were accused of corruption, theft, murder, rape, were also put in these concentration camps. Then in 1938, after the Kristallnacht pogrom, the smashing of Jewish stores, the burning of synagogues, tens of thousands of German Jews were also pushed into the concentration camps. Then throughout World War II, World War II started in 1939, throughout World War II many different nationalities were added, not just communists, but Polish and Russian nationals especially, and of course many more Jews. The conditions in the concentration camps were particularly harsh, as one would imagine. They had two purposes, these concentration camps. One was segregating these undesirable people and really punishing them, and the other was slave labor, which they increasingly needed during the course of the war. And sometimes these two purposes contradicted each other, as we'll find out. Of course, prisoners were fed very little. There was a lot of starvation. There was rampant disease, of course. When you're fed less, you're more susceptible to disease, especially typhus, and overwork. And this overwork wasn't just a consequence of the work itself. It was intentional, and sometimes work was even created. Hard labor was created when they didn't have it. This was called extermination through labor. They knew that a certain amount of prisoners would just die from overwork, from disease, from starvation. But that did, you know, contradict their demand for slave labor. So like in Auschwitz, in the middle of 1942, 20%, every month 20% of the prisoners would die from this overwork. But by the middle of 1943, as the war was progressing, there were only 3.5% of the prisoners died every month. There was continual beatings and whippings for next to nothing, for not working hard enough, for anything that the SS guards felt like, and summary executions. Sometimes these executions would be ceremonial, so you know the whole camp would, you know, be assembled to watch someone being hung, or sometimes people would just be shot, you know, just on the spot. But actually, for some, there was some relief from this horror. I was surprised to find out, before the war, there were actually periodic releases from the concentration camps, especially on Hitler's birthday. So Hitler's magnanimous, he's releasing a bunch of people. Some of these people, of course, were rearrested and put back in the concentration camps. And until later in the war, prisoners were allowed care packages with extra food, which was very helpful. Of course, Russians and Jews were not permitted to have these extra care packages because they wanted as many of them to die as possible. And the working conditions and food allotments were actually better for people who had special jobs that required special skills, and also for supervisory work, which people have called kapos. We'll talk a little bit about that later. Individual resistance, of course, was commonplace. Some people just, you know, they were ordered to, conduct a beating on behalf of the SS. They were ordered to conduct an execution, and they refused. Oftentimes, those people were immediately shot or certainly severely punished. There was one incident at the gas chambers in Auschwitz when people were stripped of their clothing and made to get in the gas chambers, where people just fought back and stabbed several guards. It wasn't planned, it wasn't organized, but things like that continued to occur. More common was really just basic kindness to other people, sharing their food, trying to hide people who were condemned to death. But I think the most effective was the organized resistance that you saw in the camp. Unfortunately, because of secrecy, many prisoners didn't even know that there was active resistance in the camps where they were interred. Organizations were able to make a difference in the life and death of individuals, possibly you could argue in the course of the war, and really in themselves and the kind of society that they hoped to build after the war. Some people had lives saved, but actually had no idea that the resistance was responsible for it. So when I talk about organized resistance, it's many different organizations, but primarily we're talking about the Communist Party, pre-existing organizations generally, the Communist Party, the Polish military, the Soviet military, and in the ghettos we're talking about an organization we'll talk about a little bit later called the Bund, also communist and Zionist organizations, and actually I was surprised to find out, like, the Boy Scouts, the Polish Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts actually were active in types of resistance, mainly humanitarian work in the concentration camps. And there are also, all these groups were organized generally separately and separately based on nationality, but there's several examples of international organization. I think each camp tried to bring the different nationalities together. And there was some kind of just basic solidarity, like there's an instance where, a priest and the communists have an agreement, so that the communist and his people guard the room and watch out for the guards whenever the priest is holding a mass, and whenever the communists are holding their Communist Party meetings, the priest, you know, watches out for the guard for them. In some camps there's much more tighter organization, and some much more looser. In Auschwitz, there was in 1943. These groups came together to form the Auschwitz Combat Group, which was really, I think, one of the most effective international organizations. All major nationalities, led by a socialist named Józef Sienkiewicz, who later became Prime Minister of Poland. He said, "Only solidarity, international cooperation, and the fight for freedom give us the right to regard ourselves as fellow fighters against the misfortune that Hitler's fascism has brought over the world." So, initially there's actually a competition among many of these groups for these positions that I mentioned, the special skills positions, the supervisory positions, positions in the armory, the tailor. Okay, I need to pick up the pace. And the two groups that were competing the most, I think, were what was called the Greens and the Reds. This has to do with the triangle of the war. The Reds were the political prisoners. The Greens were the ordinary criminals. Of course, the SS would have rather had the Greens in power because, you know, a lot of them, some of them actually had been former SS people, former stormtroopers that had committed crimes and were put in there. And many of them, they could get to share their ideology of you're the superior race, you're better than the rest, and could engage in some of the sadistic practices that the SS did. So the Reds, mostly communists, but others, made an attempt to try to, you know, get these people out. And, you know, of course, as I said, the SS would prefer the Greens, but you could find ways of, like, informing on certain cruel Green capos, you know, showing that you had specific skills in a particular way. You know, SS, you know, like a lot of these right-wingers, they, you know, they could be bribed, they could be flattered, they could be tricked. And over the course of the 1930s, you see in many concentration camps, the Reds increasingly taking over these key positions. Some of these could be incredibly helpful. This Hermann Langbein, who wrote this incredible book, this is the top book you should read, Against All Hope, Resistance, and Concentration Camps. Hermann Langbein was actually a prisoner in Auschwitz and several other concentration camps. He started out as an Austrian communist, an actor, who volunteered for the Spanish Civil War to fight against fascism. Had to leave, as the Spanish Civil War was defeated, had to leave to France, was imprisoned in France by the French government. When the Nazis took over France, he was deported to Dachau. And was able to, like, make himself known as a communist, you know, hook up with other communists, get a job as an orderly in the infirmary, and then as an orderly he was just able to memorize all the doctor's orders better than the nurses, so he was made the doctor's clerk, the doctor, the SS doctor, actually liked him. Once he was transferred to Auschwitz, that same doctor was transferred to Auschwitz, and he was made a clerk again. And he was able, as this position, to save lives, gather info, become a leadership, part of the leadership of Combat Group Auschwitz. Interestingly, after the war, he became part of the leadership of the German Communist Party, until the 1956 invasion of Hungary, and he turned against Stalinism and was expelled from the party, to his credit, actually. Many positions were not like, I don't think Langbein had to make too many compromises, but many positions were not so cut and dried, especially if you had a role as a capo, as one of these supervisors, and had to carry out the SS orders. There's one, Jakub Kozelchuk, I don't know really Polish or Yiddish or any of it, so I'm sorry if I mispronounce these things, but his job was a hangman. He was Jewish, he was a prisoner, but he was a hangman in charge of the bunker. The bunker was where they kept prisoners awaiting punishment, and you think this is a horribly brutal job, you know, you're collaborating with the Nazis. But actually, he was able, because he was in charge of the bunker, he was able to care for these prisoners when they were tortured, when they were ordered to, like, no food for them, he would give them food anyways, and he facilitated communication between the resistance and the people in this bunker. As Langbein points out, in regard to Jacob's case, the argument that many have used to excuse themselves for participating in crimes, if I had refused to take part in heinous deeds as I was ordered to, I would have lost my life, but the crimes would have been committed anyways, and probably more cruelly, is generally unacceptable. Every opportunist could justify him in this fashion. But I'm convinced that Jakob did more than that. He put up with the role of hangman in order to be able to help. This is why many people came forward to testify on his behalf when proceedings were started against him in Israel after the war. So, of course, there were some Reds that were sadistic, even though officially they're political prisoner. There were some Greens that were compassionate. One named Dietrich, a block leader in Buchenwald, said he was generously and magnanimously shared his food and cared for the prisoners, and he was in there because he had killed his wife and mother. But overall, the partial victory of Reds, I think, was a victory for the resistance and allowed them to do much better work. There's all these divisions. I'm going to have to skip over some of this, but there's all these divisions that they had to fight against in the concentration camp. There's divisions. There's some that were just stool pigeons working for the Nazis, saw it in their best interest to inform on people so that they could survive. But there are also national differences. Different languages, the Polish resented the Russians, they resented the Germans, from various invasions, things like this. Also, Russians were treated a lot worse. Many, were simply executed. Of the 10,000 that were sent to Auschwitz in the fall and winter of 41 and 42, only 186 were able to survive. Most of them were gassed immediately. And we know this happened a lot with Jews as well. And of course, there were political divisions, communists versus social democrats, which had, a rivalry even before the war. There's a few passages in here that talks about Trotskyists, and the Trotskyists, of course, were seen as in league with fascists, were often excluded, and very few of them were able to make a big impact on the resistance inside the camps. Women as well, there was active resistance among women. Women were an active part of the resistance, but rarely in the leadership, unfortunately, because of sexism. Even though, especially Jewish women were just as much victims, just as many prisoners as men. One example of resistance is this woman, Mala Zimetbaum, who served as a camp messenger and interpreter and was able to convince a lot of these capos that they should be siding with the prisoners and not with the Nazis, and that they would share the same fate as everybody else. And she was able to escape Auschwitz with a Polish man. They were both captured. She was sent to the gallows, another one of these ceremonial things where the whole camp comes out, and she was able to smuggle a razor blade, slits her own wrists, she's not going to be, and she starts smashing the guard with her bloody hand instead of just accepting her fate. It's amazing courage. So some of the actions, let's go and get into some of the action. How are we doing on time? Okay. And raising morale, music, art, tried to in Sobibor, they allowed, as they're working these people, they allowed them to sing songs. One of the dreaded SS officers had tortured so many people, had just been a victim of an air raid from the Soviet Air Force and had mangled his hand. But when he came back to work, they all said, let's sing a song for him. So they sang the song of the Soviet Air Force and drove him crazy. But this is the kind of things that, even though he started beating the principals, they, it raised their morale. Saving lives, who is getting care packages? How can we share this food? Organizing provision of food from the outside. Trying to get people to avoid transport often meant transport to, extermination. And especially if a particularly valuable person was targeted for transport, somebody had been active in the resistance, he's sick right now, he's in the infirmary, and then change his numbers for a dead person, which there were many, which was, and later on they actually started tattooing these numbers, as we know. And there are some cases where they actually have found a doctor who could change the tattoos, which must have been incredibly difficult. This created, of course, a moral dilemma, because you couldn't save everyone. You couldn't do everyone. There were thousands, millions of people that were in this situation. So sometimes Communist Party people, preference Communist Party, other Communist Party people to save, and sometimes they even actually had to change the number, not with a dead person, but with a live person. So you're actually choosing, we need to save this person, we don't know who this person is, so let's, another way of resistance was actually communication combat. The combat group Auschwitz was very good at this, actually documenting what was happening, documenting the massacre of Jews, and getting word out. So they actually did get the word out, and this was actually published in 1944 in newspapers around the world. Not on the front page often, and very little was done about that. The Allies did nothing really to stop the Holocaust. trying to escape is incredibly dangerous because once somebody escapes, they will punish the people, you know, often execute the people. Who's in your work group? Who helped you escape? Okay, all those 10 of them, you're getting killed. Also, it's very hard because where are you escaping to? You know, if the concentration camp is Germany, you don't know, most people are Nazis, Poland may be more anti-German, but incredibly anti-Semitic, a lot of people as well. There was one incident of a guy there was a farmer hiding him out, and he got drunk one night and said, you know, if you were a Jew, I'd just kill you. So, the guy was Jewish, but he was hiding it. Sometimes resistance in the camp thought an individual was so valuable and the risks were low enough that they actually facilitated an escape. I'm going to skip that. Also sabotage, you know, inmates increasingly use slave labor, and slave labor also in munitions, in war. I mean, sometimes sabotage is done on an individual basis in order to keep sane. The Polish women in Ravensbrück concentration camp had an expression that sabotage is like wine. Like, it's just, you have to do something, you know. For morale, but increasingly used in military production. Some of the bombs, weapons, you know, would find loose screws, bombs that wouldn't explode, even sometimes uniforms that had legs sewn together or wouldn't button. Just anything to mess with the Germans. And there were, of course, outright rebellions. This was always difficult because the prisoners had no weapons, they had whatever, if they could maybe provide a few weapons, but they're always going to be outgunned. And most of the prisoners are starving and weak to begin with. And anytime there's going to be a rebellion, there's going to be massive casualties. Not just the people who are rebelling, but they're going to massacre anybody that they can. Usually only happened by organized groups, and usually and people that had been in one location for long enough and long enough to plan for things, and usually only happened when all hope of surviving was dashed. So people may know, after the Germans invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, this is when the final solution really began. And it had everything to do with the invasion of the Soviet Union, because in the Nazi mentality, you know, Jews were responsible for communism, right? They were the originators of communism. It's funny that they're both capitalist and anti-capitalist, you know, in their mindset. Like, they're the greedy bankers, and they're the communists who are disrupting national unity and everything. So that they thought, actually, they're diverting all this resources from the war effort to the Holocaust. But they didn't see it as a contradiction because they thought killing Jews is part of the war effort. That's the part of the fight against communism. So initially, of course, there was something called the Einsatzgruppen, these SS groups that would actually find, once they invaded a town, find all the Jews, take them out, make them dig a ditch, and shoot them. This happened, hundreds of thousands, maybe a million people were killed in this way. But actually, thousands were able to escape to the forests and swamps in the Soviet Union areas that they invaded. Famously, there's the Bielski brothers. There's set up a community of several hundred people hiding out in the swamps for months, and able, after they destroyed all these towns, able to come back to the towns, set up their own towns. There was like 1,200 people in this town. They had a marketplace, they had blacksmiths, shoemakers, a doctor that you could visit, and everything was shared. All the resources were shared together. These were Jews who were in Nazi territory, but were able to, you know, and apparently there's a movie with Daniel Craig about this. But the ghettos, which, you know, when the Nazis invaded Poland in 1939, they set up these special areas, special parts of the city, isolated areas where they held Jews. But they weren't that much better than concentration camps. They're really concentration camps within cities. But after the final solution, people know that they met in Wannsee in January 1942 and decided, let's not just shoot them, let's set up a whole series of extermination camps where they're systematically gassed. And this was in order to do this, they started liquidating the ghettos, which is where they knew where the Jews were. Jews had to fight back in order to survive. And throughout these ghettos, you see resistance happening in Vilna and Częstochowa and Bialystok. But the most famous one, of course, was the Warsaw Ghetto, and actually one of the most successful for a time. In the ghetto, you know, Jews, you know, paid poverty wages. They had employment, but there was massive starvation, massive disease, and summary executions by the SS. By mid-1942, 10 to 15 people a night would be shot, some of them for smuggling, some just for being out after curfew. The classic account, I don't have the paper book here, but there's a book, a very short book called The Ghetto Fights by Mark Edelman, who is a participant in the, and people should pick that up. I thought we had it in the Haymarket, but we don't. It's published, the latest version is published by Bookmarks. You should get it online. But Edelman was a member of the Bund, which was a Jewish revolutionary socialist anti-Zionist group, and actually one of the largest among the Jewish community in Poland, and tried to organize the ghetto from the beginning. They had a revolutionary socialist newspaper called Der Werke, which I guess is Yiddish for worker, maybe. And one of their tasks was try to convince people that in the ghetto that we needed to do something, that we are going to be exterminated unless we resist. And they, again and again, they tried to publicize stories of what was happening. There was all this evidence. You know, they actually had people follow the trains back to where, you know, where their destination, which is Treblinka, which is where they were gassed, and came back with all these evidence. But still, most people were not willing to rebel because they could, if they could excuse it, then they did, right? Because no one wants to face this. And they also, to them, it didn't seem to make sense. Well, they want our labor. Why would killing us benefit them in any way? But more and more groups of people began to be rounded up. They would actually bribe Jews to come to be transported out to the extermination camps. They said, here, we'll give you bread and marmalade. We'll give you, everybody who comes will get bread and marmalade. And they thought, they can't, they're giving us food. They're not trying to kill us. They must be telling the truth that they're just resettling us. And the Bund tried to save, you know, as many as they could, try to convince people not to come, try to hide people, try to sneak people out through the hospital, but it was not enough. One comrade, Sonia Novogrodzka, remarked, "The working masses march in formation to the train station. I have to go with them. If I shall be with them, then perhaps they will not forget that they are human beings, even during their very last moments in the cars and afterwards." And 2 days later, she was taken to, arrested and deported to Treblinka herself. Finally, in October, enough people were ready to risk a fight, and several, the Bund got together with two of the youth Zionist organizations to form this Jewish fighting organization, which is known by its initials, ZOB. They asked for help from the Polish resistance organization, the Home Army, and got, you know, 10 pistols, some of which didn't really work. But in January of 1943, they launched their first street battle, which is a direct assault on German soldiers as they were rounding up Jews to be evacuated to extermination camps. Most of the resistors were massacred. Of the fighters that took part, 4/5 were killed, but they were able to actually put a dent on in the Germans and actually kill several German soldiers, and inspired people. Both the Jewish resistance and Poles outside, the Poles actually gave them more weapons, not nearly enough, but they did. And they began to, like, the ZOB kind of take charge of the ghetto and tax Jewish businesses, including the Jewish council, the Judenrat, who'd been collaborating with the Germans. The Germans felt like they could not roam safely in the ghetto, and there are no-go areas for the Germans in the ghetto. Then on April 19th in 1943, the Germans said, okay, we're going to clear this out. The German troops and the Polish allies attempted to come in with tanks and artillery. And Mila and Zamenhofa streets, they were ambushed by the Jewish resistors, whatever rifles, pistols, they had homemade grenades they threw at them, Molotov cocktails. then, and the Germans were caught off guard. They're going haywire. One eyewitness says, there runs a German soldier shrieking like an insane one, the helmet of his head on fire. Another one shouts madly, Judenwaffen, Judenwaffen, Jews, weapons, Jews, weapons. The SS tanks were called in not to attack and destroy, but actually to enable the few troops that were left to retreat. And a tank was set on fire with a Molotov cocktail. That day there were two major battles. By 2 p.m. not a single German was left in the ghetto. Okay. the next day, the Germans tried to enter the ghetto, only to find a booby trap. 100 soldiers died in the explosion. They're unable to enter the ghetto that day or the next. And then the day after that, they tried negotiating the Jews to surrender, which they didn't believe and wouldn't put up with. And finally, the Germans did what the only foolproof way of defeating the uprising. They started setting fire to the ghetto from without. And then they just went house to house with flamethrowers, setting each house on fire. So the ZOB had to try new tactics, which was just protecting the population that existed. In the midst of this, the workers' holiday of May Day occurred. They started out May Day with a holiday attack on the Germans, and then in the evening, they got together, had speeches, and finally sang the Internationale. And Edelman says this about, never yet had the Internationale been sung in conditions so different, so tragic, in a place where an entire nation had been and was still perishing. The words in the song echoed from the charred ruins and were, at that particular time, an indication that socialist youth were still fighting in the ghetto, and that even in the face of death, they were not abandoning their ideals. The remaining fighters hunkered down in bunkers. The Germans attacked them bunker by bunker. In one bunker, there were 5 battle groups and hundreds of civilians holed up, but a narrow entrance to the bunker, David Hochberg decided to wedge himself into the entrance. Of course, he was killed, but it was able to stall enough time so that everybody else could escape by another entrance. Eventually, the battle was lost. A handful of ZOB fighters made it out through the sewers, including Edelman, on May 10th. A few more vowed to fight on to the end, but nothing was heard from them after mid-June. So the last transport for the Warsaw Ghetto ended up in Treblinka. Along with the news of the uprising, they brought the message, now it's up to you. Treblinka was an extermination camp. Most Jews that came there were there just to be gassed, but there were several hundred, couple thousand, that were used to just maintain the camp and maintain this machinery of death and sort through the clothing and, you know, bring the Jews to the oven, the ovens, the gas chambers, all that. Treblinka launched their own, I'm going to have to skip through some of this, but Treblinka launched their own uprising, were able to gain access. They had a locksmith, was able to gain access to the armory, reproduce the lock. So once they knew that all hope of not just the Jews that were coming in, but they were actually going to liquidate the entire camp, the Soviet army was approaching, they knew there was no hope left, so they had to rebel. So they came to the armory and got weapons. The password to get a weapon was death, and the response was always life. So you can imagine them, death, life, death, life, as they're getting arms, axes, rifles, pistols, again, homemade grenades. This was not as successful because a stool pigeon had ratted on that. They had to take the uprising sooner than they thought necessary. 500 people were able to go beyond the fence. A few hundred escaped, but many died. They tried to make it to the partisans, but actually some were killed by the home army, the anti-Semitic home army, who was supposed to be opposing the Nazis. Auschwitz, the Sonderkommandos, the people working the ovens, tried a rebellion as well. They were able to burn down one of the crematorium, but all of them were massacred. And Sobibor was actually the most famous uprising. A man named Leon Feldhandler had been there and for months trying to think up plans of poisoning the guards, setting things on fire, you know, killing the stool pigeon. How can they bring about a rebellion? And they'd heard about Treblinka and they'd heard about what happened in Warsaw. And he was in luck because in September 43, there was a whole shipment of Soviet soldiers, Jewish soldiers, that came to Sobibor to work. One of them was Alexander Pechersky, who was a real character, a natural leader, and told everybody that we can't wait for liberation from outside. We have to do it ourselves. It's not coming from the Soviet army. You know, by the time the Soviet army get there, they'd probably all be dead. If I have time for this. It's 35 minutes. I probably don't have time. Anyways, he was... He got together, Russian soldier, this Jewish Polish worker, a Feldhandler, and planned a rebellion. They didn't even speak the same language because Pechersky didn't speak any Yiddish and didn't speak any Polish, but they were able, through interpreters, they had a group of 30 conspirators led by seven. They even got one of the more violent capos to switch sides and do this operation with them. They set October 14th as the day of the uprising. They begin to procure weapons. A lot of children actually procured weapons because the SS would trust children to work, you know, as tailors, as shining shoes, as different, and they would steal weapons. They would steal ammunition wherever they got the opportunity. They started out the rebellion on October 14th by killing the informant that they knew, Berliner, who they knew was going to inform on them. And they worked on the corruptness and the vainness of these SS officers. So they'd say, oh, look, among all the clothes of these victims, we found a really good suit for you. You should come try it on. So, and they would say, oh, we'd find a good suit, coat, boots, whatever. And they'd enter into the tailor's office. Oh, let's measure you, and then hack the person to pieces. They did this for six officers in the end. 11 SS officers were killed. And several Ukrainian, they had guards that they, you know, they were Ukrainians that they didn't really trust, but they were supposed to be guards of the camp. They ended up killing 38 of Ukrainian guards. 40 of them ran away because they were afraid of being killed as well. So you have this, once they were able to kill all these, and they blew the whistle, which was the, we're escaping, we're charging. It was led by the 70 Russian soldiers in the front. Unfortunately, they were not able to get the most brutal, we'll just call him Franz, because this is what Pechersky called him, the commandant of the camp. He didn't come for his appointment at the tailor, so he was able to, you know, rouse what people were left and get the machine guns and start to mow people down. So they tried to storm the gate. Only a few people made it past the gate. Somebody with a machine gun had stood at the gate. They went towards the fence. And some were able to cut through the fence, some were able to climb over the fence. Some just died on the fence. Outside of the fence was a minefield. Some that were able to get close to they figured they could get close to the SS barracks, you know, were able to escape the minefield. But a lot of people were not in on the conspiracy and just wanted to escape. And, you know, the only way was to let the person in front of you go through the minefield, die, and then you could hop from body to body and know how to get out. 500 to 600 inmates got out. 300 breached the fence. Many joined the partisans in the forest, but only 50 to 60 survived the war. In 1965, there was a court case on this in Germany, and the judge issued a ruling which mentioned that the Sobibor uprising was crushed. Pechersky, who had survived the war, was adamant that this was a lie. He said this is a brazen lie. It was not crushed. It was successful. Practically all the prisoners escaped. It was this that caused the fascists to liquidate the camp. Finally, at the end of the war, all camps were being liquidated, right? And liquidation meant that you were going to be marched. Thank you. That they were going to be marched to another camp, you know, again with no food, you know, knowing that most people are not going to make it to the next camp. Auschwitz, this happened. The Auschwitz, they had a planned revolt. It was all, they were coordinating with the Allies, they had communication with the Allies. Unfortunately, the Allies sent a very incompetent, a guy named Urban, this British officer, to communicate with them. He ended up getting captured and being sent to Auschwitz himself. But the uprising was foiled in Auschwitz, and they marched them to Bergen-Belsen across the country. 44,000 were marched, only 20,000 arrived. And by the time the Red Army reached there, there were only 7,500 prisoners left alive. Similar plans fell through in Dora and Nuningam, but in Buchenwald, which was like one of the oldest and best organized resistance, this didn't happen. They'd been putting aside, they'd been preparing for this and preparing for the end of the war, putting aside weapons from the armory, doing arms training with unloaded guns, like this is how you pull the trigger in the washroom. They would do this, collecting homemade grenades, Molotov cocktails, and even one machine gun that the SS Guard had accidentally left under a bunch of dead bodies. On April 4th, 1945, the attempt to liquidate the camp began, and they ordered all the Jews to come and line up the roll call. The Jews refused and actually ripped off their stars and tried to mingle in with the rest of the prisoners. And actually, the senior block commanders refused to go find the Jews, even though, oh, we can't find them. And they were actually, SS officers by force were able to find 1,500 Jews, but 4,500 more blended in with everybody else. Thanks. Because the Communist Party actually had most of the administrative positions in the camp, they were able to slow down the carrying out of the orders. The SS were very frustrated. What should have taken them 2 hours to accomplish actually took 2 days. 46 troublemakers were supposed to be executed right away, but they were hidden by the resistance. Some of them were able to escape the camp. They had a hidden transmitter, which they were using just for this, and transmitted to the American, SOS to the American troops. On April 7th, they had a roll call. People refused to show up. But they were able, by force, to clear out 25,000 people from the camp to do another forced death march. But more than 20,000 people were still left. By April 11th, the resistance had, so many SS officers had left, the resistance ordered all the guards to come down. Prisoners streamed through the gates, hacked down the dreaded electric fence, and arrested the remaining SS people. The senior camp inmate Heinz Eiden announced from the loudspeaker, "Comrades, we are free. The SS bandits have run away." When the American tanks, tanks finally got there, they came to the gates of Buchenwald and said, "You guys okay?" They said, "Yes, okay, we're going to Berlin." And they left the resistance basically in charge of the camp. When the U.S. Army finally returned, the U.S. officer said, "We admire you for having managed to preserve such unity, order, and strength under the Nazi terror. You're the best of Europe. You've taken 1,500 SS men prisoner." A similar thing happened at Dachau and Mauthausen, which also had very organized resistance. So, what's this all mean today? I think today we have a very different situation. We still have the ability to organize, and we do organize, and this conference can attest to this. There's no mass murder, no fascism for real, but I think sometimes it seems like the horrors of Trump's can be overwhelming. The attacks on workers, the attacks on reproductive rights, the attacks on immigrants, and this continual fostering of a far-right racism. It can be incredibly depressing sometimes. I know some people in my branch that have become demoralized at how right-wing our country and this world and become. But I think it's important to remember the example of resistance during the Holocaust, to know that even the darkest time, when literally there was no hope, that as long as there's organization, there's politics, that the fight continues no matter what. That because of these people's, I think, dedication to struggle, that they created hope when there really wasn't hope. One of the best quotes, I think, from Trotsky is he was writing a letter to a friend in the late 1937, after the victory of Stalinism, after the victory of fascism, when the world seemed horrid. And his friend was just incredibly depressed. And his response, indignation, anger, revulsion, yes, even temporary weariness. All this is human, only too human. But I will not believe that you have succumbed to pessimism. This would be like passively and plaintively taking umbrage at history. How can one do that? History has to be taken as she is. And when she allows herself such extraordinary and filthy outrages, one must fight back at her with one's fists. Victims of the Holocaust fought back with their fists, and no matter what the situation, that's our task today.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.